Welcome to The Indigenous Approach, a podcast where we examine the role of the nation's premier partnership force across the competition continuum, from cooperation to conflict and everything in between. In this episode, members of the Civil Affairs Regiment discuss the civil affairs role in the Great Power Competition and the importance of cross-functional teams in the 1st Special Forces Command vision.
Greetings, I am Sam Hayes, Lieutenant Colonel, the Interagency Coordinator at the 95th Civil Affairs Brigade Special Operations Airborne. This episode will focus on civil affairs in the Great Power Competition, and we'll also discuss some things that we see in the vision that has challenged us from 1st Special Forces Command. Today, we have three accomplished civil affairs professionals across the regiment that I would like to welcome to today's episode. First, we have Major Travis Clemens, who is a current company commander in the brigade, who's also wrote extensively on this topic. Travis, welcome. Next, we have Major Sal Raza, who is a director at WINSEC, which stands for Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, who also is a published author. Welcome. Last, we have Master Sergeant Sean Acosta, who was in the Information Dominance Detachment at 7th Group. He was NCO of the Year in 2018 and also is a published author. Thank you, Sean, for joining us on today. As you guys know, around 2017 and 18, there are several documents by our national leaders who have directed our attention to our near peer competitors like Russia and China. As they describe this environment, they're really outlining great power competition, which forces us to shift our paradigm and how we fight the next fight. As we shift, we must think on how we contribute as civil affairs professionals to this fight, fostering a competitive mindset to win. With that said, I kind of want to ask Travis, you have done some deep thinking at NPS, Naval Postgraduate School. You recently wrote a monograph for JSAL. I kind of want you to talk to us about the great work that you have done on this important topic, and then also tie it to what the 95th brings to the fight: civil reconnaissance, civil engagement, and also human network analysis as it relates to great power competition. All right, talk to us, Travis.
Hey, thanks, sir. I took where civil affairs is at now in terms of doctrine, organization training, and equipment, and really deep dived and analyzed how do we apply those capabilities in the modern competitive environment. So part of what I did is take a look at what that competitive environment is now, because whether it's competition against Russia or China, it's going to be different in how we approach it. But the capabilities that CA brings are generally the same across the board. And what I did is I took those four things, doctrine, organization training, and material, in order to define that unique capability that CA has. The way the brigade describes it is in those core tasks, essentially, right? Civil reconnaissance, civil engagement, and human network analysis. Those are the three things that, as a force, soft CA does that nobody else in the DoD enterprise really hits at. Not in the same way that we do, or in the same environments that we do. And so I looked at what role can we apply these capabilities to in the competitive environment. What I found was really there's four main roles that soft CA has. Initial entry, which is the first DoD elements or deployed military forces in a country other than embassy personnel, of course, are often civil affairs teams. And so we're already pre-positioned to establish relationships with the US country team, with the host nation, in order to lay the groundwork for whatever follow-on campaign plan is in place in that country. We can identify specific nodes, whether those are individuals of influence or whether those are physical infrastructure nodes that are going to be needed for the follow-on forces. The second role is basic reconnaissance. Civil reconnaissance is a core task, but this is more than just the civil reconnaissance. This is reconnaissance as a concept of being those eyes and ears and being the sensors for other elements to shape battle space. In our case, that's a human domain to support whatever the broader campaign is. The third is engage in influence. Now, this is something we do as our bread and butter. I applied it to just specifically within the great power competition realm. We do a lot of engage in influence in counterterrorism and COIN operations, but I didn't really go into those. I only went into how we apply this against a great power adversary. And it really breaks down into three different ways. The first is inoculating a foreign population, a third country population, from adversarial messaging. A lot of studies show, you know, the rule of primacy applies when it comes to information. The first message you get is the one that somebody is going to stick with, despite what might follow on. Even if something comes around to refute that message, a lot of people aren't going to really accept the follow-on refutation. So you have to get these vulnerable populations first and inoculate them. And studies have shown that if you can inoculate them, let them understand the type of misinformation that's coming in, the methods being used, or the fact that there's somebody specific who is trying to feed them misinformation or disinformation or propaganda, a lot of times they are less susceptible to that. You can't get into that. It's countering the effects of that propaganda or that messaging. And that's that civil engagement piece, which is working with local communities, with key leaders, with just populations in general. And if an adversary is trying to get a certain population or a certain vulnerable community to perhaps not vote in a local election, the civil affair teams on the ground are uniquely positioned that they can counter some of those effects. So if an adversary is trying to get a population to not vote, civil affairs teams on the ground can help reduce the obstacles to voting, whether it's organizing transportation to the polling places, organizing and helping support host nation build more polling sites, you know, breaking down those barriers that messaging then is no longer useful because the barriers that the messaging depends on are no longer an obstacle to the population. And the last piece of that engage and influence is mobilizing a population. Now, this is less geared towards trying to counter or trying to get the effects of any messaging. And this is getting the population that we work with to mobilize in a way that we want. And this is done through the network analysis of who are the key nodes of a population, the engagement, the civil engagement with those key people, with that population, to mobilize them to do, you know, whatever it is that meets our goal within the campaign, the broader campaign of that area. And then finally, the fourth role in great power competition that I identified for Soft CA is support to resistance. This is more than just unconventional warfare. UW is a small subset and it's pretty well laid out, CA's role within UW doctrinally. But the broader support to resistance is where really in a great power environment, I think we really will make our money. And that's developing resilient communities that can resist if it came to it, you know, whether it's enemy occupation. It's building a deterrence capability within that civil community. Because if a community on a border or in a vulnerable area to an adversary's, whether it's a military reaction against that community, an invasion, or whether it's a less overt method of maintaining control outside of just the adversary's borders, a resilient, well-placed and well-organized civil community changes the calculus for that adversary. If we can't build that resistance ahead of time to deter, you can help support the resistance in an already occupied or already controlled area by the adversary. Those resilient networks, the classic unconventional warfare structures, the shadow governance, if it gets to that. And then the third piece is undermining an adversary's efforts in a third country location that isn't necessarily one that they control. For example, it's working through having civil affairs teams work through a host nation's overt legal and civil structures and framework in order to increase the cost on an adversary, whether that's slowing down certifications, licensing for construction sites, and using our network and our contacts and our relationships to help a host nation navigate perhaps some of these complexities of deals and international relations with other countries. And sometimes even it's just bringing light to some of the contracts between one entity or the other. The PRC often uses contracts that are not seen by anybody other than the people that are agreeing to them with no third party verification of the terms or adjudication of those terms. So it can be just as much as providing translators to help the host nation navigate through these contracts and getting a third set of eyes on them in order to help influence that host nation to make decisions that are beneficial to themselves and not just supporting an adversary to the U.S. So that's really the rundown of the roles that I identified in this work with JSAL and as my MPS thesis within Great Power Competition. It was all based on how do we apply these three key tasks, CR, CE, and HNA, in a way that gets at our national policy with regards to our great power competitors.
Travis, no, thanks for that so much for that rundown. You really kind of illuminated some things that I really want to get into. But before I ask any other questions, let me ask Raza or Sean, do you have any thoughts that Travis kind of illuminated in you as he was talking?
No, Sam, thanks for the question. And Travis, you know, first, congratulations with getting published at JSAL. That's an accomplishment, man. You know, thumbs up to you. And, you know, I skimmed through, I didn't get to finish the entire book. I do got a hard copy though. So appreciate it. But yes, Solar Reconnaissance, Civil Engagement, Human Network Analysis, and Great Power Competition is probably gonna be one of the most important things that's gonna be able to inform our senior leaders at all levels, both DOD and, you know, all the way up to a National Security Council. I agree with you. One thing for me is, you know, in human network analysis, you know, not just understanding who's who in the zoo, but, you know, the perceptions and how are populations in these different areas receiving the information and interpreting it themselves, right? And that's key for us to be able to inform them, because we see, you know, if we're looking at like in Europe, you know, Russia's exploiting diasporas of, you know, out there, China using economic means to be able to influence indigenous populations that are ignored by their governments themselves. So I think it's really good. I appreciate it, brother.
And thanks, Ross, for those comments. Sean, do you have any other thoughts on the matter?
Yeah, and I think we'll get into it a little bit more, sir, but when we start talking about cross-functional teams. But I think it's important to understand that when it comes to great power competition, if you look at, you know, what General Brennan and his staff put together as far as first observe, right, civil affairs plays a large role in that within great power competition. You think of ourselves as the global scouts, essentially, of SOF, identifying these civil networks and the civil information. Specifically, you know, you look at China and South America, and it's already been touched on some of the economic exploitation of those indigenous populations that's occurring. You know, Major Clemens just spoke about that. But, you know, those things are not always observable by our GEM partners or Department of State. Oftentimes, they have difficulties getting out of those capital regions. And when it comes to civil reconnaissance, civil affairs is that asset that provides that capability, that niche capability to USASOC versus SFC, and also to share that information with our interagency, intergovernmental, and multinational partners.
As Sean unpacked this concept of a global scout, looking at the observable things that are not really apparent to our partners, who do you think should be able to consume what we bring in our networks to the RSOF enterprise?
So that's the tough question, right? Is teams go out, and I think everybody here has lived it, come back with massive amounts of reporting, massive amounts of data. It's really organizing and analyzing that information and packaging it in a way to drive decisions. A big part of that is tying into targeting cycles, into information flow, whether it's intel channels or ops channels. And so that information, not just the raw data, but the actual analyzed information gets to the right people who can make decisions based on what it is we're reporting. It's great to say, hey, I got all this information in this one area. Super cool, really interesting. Nobody else knows it, but so what? And it's making sure that you're tied into a broader campaign. That was one of the points I tried hard to make in the monograph. None of this matters if it's not founded in overarching policy and campaign, you know, in the areas that we're sending these teams to. The roles I identified don't matter if they're not tied to the broader operation and an end state goal. There's no point in doing, you know, initial entry if there's no follow-on forces. If not, reconnaissance is driven by PIRs. And so it's answering those PIRs and the operations process in our part, but it's also getting the information to the State Department in their various forms wherever we're at, to make sure that they can make decisions. Because a lot of times, I've lived it, and I'm sure the other folks here on the discussion have lived it, is we can get to places where State Department can't. The only information they get is through their partners. That may or may not be correct. We can actually get on the ground and eyes on. And so it's making sure that they get that info as well so that it drives their decisions. If the information we're gathering and the analysis we're doing, if it's not tied to drive a decision or drive an action, then we need to realign how we're using it and what we're doing with our forces.
No, that's really great point. And thank you, Travis. I kind of want to shift the direction to something that's near and dear to my heart. Really looking at this competition space and understanding it, you know, to your point exactly, who is consuming that information? And to build on Sean's point, you know, as we're the global scouts, those strategic sensors on the ground, what are we doing with this to really understanding where our competitors are moving, where they're going next, to anticipate their moves is critically important to the combined fight. Oftentimes, you know, as civil affairs teams prepare to go, they kind of start with open source research in terms of where am I going? Who are the actors there? What's available? And they begin to paint the picture of this civil combat operation picture before they go down range. And they have this iterative conversation with the team that might be there before them. And they begin to unpack what they see going on in the environment. And as they prepare for their missions, and as they get on the ground, they begin to confirm or deny what they understand. And the way that we do this is through human network analysis. And as we visualize this picture, what's really important is understanding the relationships, the ability to look at the individual level to understand, is this a person of influence? How do I want to target the scene of individual? How do I want to influence them? How do we share that information? Or do I want to look at the organizations this person's involved in? You know, I know there's a very bright captain in the 92nd who's really unpacking this competition space analysis built off of human network analysis, understanding how he was able to see we are in the wrong place and we need to look elsewhere. And that was very critical to his operations and the combined fight downrange. You know, one of the things that we're often focused on is the enemy. But there's multiple networks out there. If you can imagine the complexity and the ambiguity that we play in, we play with enemy networks, we play with friendly networks, we play with neutral networks, we play with NGOs, that civ-mil nexus that we are charged with, to unpack that in a way that it can make sense to commanders and provide relevant information for decision-making. As we unpack this environment and understand what's going on, oftentimes we fail to look at our blue networks, our friendly networks, our unified action partners, those interagencies that have tremendous bandwidth, that has capabilities beyond what we have when we're in theater. And oftentimes, if we can do a better job of understanding what they bring to the fight, we can have civ-mil convergence in a space where we need to unpack an issue that we do not have the capability to do. I know my teams, they were in Africa, they did such a thing. They did open source research, they found out what was going on. When they got on the ground, they confirmed and they adjust fire, but they realized the people they met along the way and the interagency, I have a question that I cannot answer. And they reached back and it provided timely and relevant information for them to adjust. And it was in the right place they adjust to meet the ambassador's objectives in that given country. And it was phenomenal when it happened. So I challenge all of us as practitioners and as we go about our day and our mission planning to also remember the power that our unified action partners bring. As you can tell, I'm passionate about that because it's kind of the sixth man. It's kind of that ability to punch above your weight in areas where our four-man team are often doing good things. But I'll pause right there to see if any others have any experiences in that same vein or different thoughts they would like to share or even a different angle.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's critical in understanding those friendly networks that we have that we can leverage, not only as part of interagency or other unified action partners, but it's important to remember those NGOs, like you were saying. I think we've all had personal experience dealing with that. But the reason why I think it's most important, when we look at the civil engagement piece of it and influence being our biggest tool as civil affairs, right, as our weapon system, oftentimes the resources that we have are finite. So when we start looking at these civil vulnerabilities that we've identified, and in great power competition, we start looking at how threat networks are exploiting those civil vulnerabilities for their own purposes, i.e. China and South America or Russia and Europe. The resources that we have to put against, you know, rectifying or correcting that civil vulnerability are finite when it comes to Department of Defense at times. So without those interagency networks or those unified action partners working alongside of us, we're not going to have the resources to overcome that. So those are critical. I've experienced it in multiple places, you know, in Afghanistan, obviously that's a little outside of great power competition, but when we look at places like Africa where I've been, you know, you have CCP very active in Africa, doing some of the same things they're doing all over. So it's extremely important to understand those capabilities that our partners have, what resources they have, how do we, you know, work with one another to meet those end states. And back to the information piece, if you will, and understanding that civil data, oftentimes they've been there much longer than we have as well. So I think it's important to remember we have a finite rotation cycle, right? We're only in country so many days, whereas they are there for the long haul in most cases. So they understand that environment much better than we do. You know, they've lived it on the ground. They are not trying to do open source research before they come in like we are and understand that and then rapidly evolve what that operational environment looks like once we're on the ground. So, you know, it's a great resource. And if you're not leveraging those and using them, you're kind of putting yourself at a disadvantage. And when it comes to great power competition, it is, to use a cliche, a whole of government approach. So without those unified action partners, we're not doing anything as far as meeting U.S. government's objectives and those national security strategy objectives.
No, thanks, Sean. I think you're spot on in terms of that whole government approach. They're leveraging, our competitors are better sometimes at leveraging and having those echelon of influence in a given space that they're choosing. And we definitely need to outmaneuver them in that information, that cognitive and virtual and physical domains, because our nation is asking us to do that. Roz, what are your thoughts on the matter?
I agree with Sean. You know, the fight, great power competition is going to be all interagency. And I just kind of want to add, you know, what Sean was talking about, authorities and resources, understanding what our interagency partners bring to the fight or to great power competition, but also what are the mechanisms out there to be able to share this information, to be able to leverage this. There's already mechanisms going on that we can fall into, our teams can fall into, or companies or echelons above companies can fall into to be able to coordinate and leverage some of these resources or establishing our own. As a CA guy, you know, as a company commander, we had a CMO sync with all our USAID and state partners, and we do it once a week on a Friday to be able to, you know, share what our teams were doing on the ground, and they can tell us what they're doing on the ground, what their implementing partners were doing on the ground from the NGO side. And then, you know, seeing, you know, where identify opportunities for us to be able to identify, you know, the mutual areas that we can kind of work towards together. So, you know, spot on. I think, Sean, I'm there with you, just trying to identify those mechanisms where we can share this information.
Looking at the current competitive environment, like armed conflict is such a small piece of it, you know, and that's of course what the military always focuses on, because that's our bread and butter. That's what we do. But there are vast number of other mechanisms that nation states can use to coerce or influence another nation, you know, whether it's information operations, as we would call it, against population, you know, or political warfare, or sometimes as it's referred to. Economic statecraft, like the PRC does with the Belt and Road Initiative, that Russia uses its oil pipelines in Eastern Europe to affect, you know, cyber operations. Here in the U.S., we hold that under military authorities, you know, cyber comms. That's just an organizational thing we do here. Other nations use cyber operations in a lot of different manner, you know, and finally, a big part of it is just the international institutions piece, UN, NATO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, right? All these international institutions, all of these different domains are extremely important for us to understand how they're interacting in whichever country we're deployed to, because they all affect how we interact as a country with our adversaries in that particular location. And the military side of it is so vastly small. That is one of the unique capabilities that we bring, is that we can touch those as a civil affairs professional or a team, whether it's a team on the ground, whether it's an individual in another organization, all those domains in different ways to help either bring resources to bear, coordinate different resources across our unified action partners. You know, that's where it becomes really important to know who's out there, who has similar interests that align with ours, so we can create that effect across these different domains. Because yeah, the military side of it is so vastly small in most cases. When you're really talking great power competition, if it's not a large scale war, it's not military then, it's somebody else. And so it's finding how we interact with that and where we fit within that broader construct of a unified government approach to the particular problem.
I know we've been talking about a lot of theoretical things, and I kind of want to pivot to a concrete example. Roz, I know you have a vast experience with the UAP, Unified Action Partners, and also in great power competition in your neck of the woods. Can you take some time to just kind of unpack your experience and paint the picture for us so we can make it really concrete of what's going on?
Absolutely. So Unified Action Partners, I'm going to focus more on the echelons above teams, because most of my experience is working at the company commander level to subjective level type staff and TSOC staff to be able to leverage some of the resources and information with our Unified Action Partners and identifying which Unified Action Partners are there in the area. So, you know, working with state and aid and sharing that information with them to be able for them to have a better understanding and a common operating picture, not just from the DOD side, but for them to have understand where vulnerable populations are influenced by adversaries in some areas and how we can leverage some of the resources and programs that they have to be able to challenge that on the ground. You know, I'll keep it at that, but I think it's, you know, making sure that we have civil affairs representation at all echelons to be able to leverage that for the teams on the ground and making sure that the information is getting to the right people that we can leverage at that. You know, focusing on the Southcom area and the AOR area, you know, I know we've talked about, you know, some of the things that's been going on down there. I think Sean kind of hit on it in the economic exploitation of vulnerable populations down in Central and South America. You know, knowing that China is one of the number one trading partners to several countries down in especially South America. You can look at Brazil, you can look at Peru, they are the number one trading partners out there. So because of that, and because of their activities going on down there, they've already started conditioning the people that they are the better partner to partner with. So you're looking at vulnerable population on the ground that really don't understand the geopolitical aspects behind it, the strategic aspects about it. So there, you know, when Chinese front real estate agents come and try to buy land off of them, they're going to sell it. They feel like, I'm not doing anything wrong here. I'm going to sell my land. I need the money, especially if there are populations that have been ignored by their governments. You know, so for example, I kind of want to highlight, you know, one of the things that happened in El Salvador. I'm not sure if many of you guys have heard about the Isla Perico. The island of Perico is right off the coast of El Salvador out there. And China had gone on there trying to buy all the land off the indigenous population that lives on the island and displaced them onto the mainland. And that was something that, you know, no, it wasn't in anybody's eyes. And, you know, the ambassador had caught it last minute and tried to stop it. But also, they were also on the coast, on the mainland, purchasing businesses right on the coast for their own long-term strategic objectives, right? And, you know, most of these indigenous populations are unwitting collaborators. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know why. They just see money. They're like, okay, yeah, we'll buy it. So these are some of the things that civil affairs, you know, through their civil reconnaissance, civil engagement, trying to get that information and be like, okay, yes, these populations here are getting influenced. If there's one Chinese company buying a business here, there's probably 100 more somewhere else.
Thanks, Raza, for showing that. You know, sometimes when we have a signature in the environment, there's many other signatures we will never see. And, you know, and that competition space analysis, that human network analysis kind of paints those invisible actions that other people don't see. Travis, do you have any other experiences, you know, comparable to Raza's that are noteworthy to our conversation?
No, nothing that concrete. I mean, I know I spent a lot of time in Africa and we regularly heard about how Chinese fishing was depleting the fishing waters off the coast. Chinese companies were building roads and mines and whatever. This isn't necessarily that everything is belligerent, but there are foreign policy implications to PRC activities in these countries that may or may not align with U.S. policy. Because of our access, because we're out working in these areas, in most cases, we're the first people that are have any ability to report to the broader U.S. government that these things are happening, that, hey, there's Chinese construction companies in these areas. There's a new road. Population says it was built by Chinese. And that just goes back into that reconnaissance role. The global scouts that Sean said, I think that's a fantastic way to describe it. As a force and in the competitive environment, the first thing that we do is that role as a scout and just understanding the environment, you know, fighting for information and then, you know, gain and maintain contact. In our case, it's contact with the human domain, with those populations, those vulnerable populations. And it's identified through that analysis. And then that iterative process, working with the host nation, working with the country team, this population, this group or this particular area is vulnerable or important to us, and it's gain and maintain contact with them so that we have that information flow as things develop and as, you know, the environment changes. You have that background and that context within the team or the company level to say, okay, that's new over there. Why is it? Who's building that? You know, who's building that building? Why is this land starting to get cleared and starting to get involved in understanding that and reporting that so that when those things change, that we have an understanding and plans can be built. It can drive those decisions.
Sean, I know that you have a vast experience as well. Any other noteworthy items to the conversation we're having that you would like to share?
Major Clemens brought up a good point as far as, you know, those fundamentals of reconnaissance and how they apply. While we're on that topic, I'll just kind of talk about that a bit. And it really ties in with what civil affairs is being asked to do, right? And when we talk about civil reconnaissance being proprietary to CA, not reconnaissance in itself, right? Obviously, we have scouts that do that elsewhere. But in this environment, focused on the civil domain, there is no other branch that's being asked to do this. This is a unique civil affairs capability. Two of the fundamentals that come to mind for me when I think about it are perform continuous reconnaissance on key terrain, right, specifically. So when we're talking about key terrain, we're talking about these populations. We're talking about individuals, organizations, or just social groups in themselves. Major Clem has mentioned the fishing off of Africa. You can imagine the fishermen along that coastal region are affected, that population, their families are affected, right? So that is, you know, one form of economic exploitation that China's doing throughout the globe. And there's many other examples that could go with it, right? But those were being reported on by civil affairs practitioners on the ground. And in this context, we're talking a lot about this at a big level, right? And then you start talking about, okay, so what assets and resources does civil affairs have to apply to it, you know, and that's a different discussion at that point. You know, we're talking more information related capabilities at that point, integrating those into the fight. It's really more IO when it comes to great power competition. And that all goes back to those unified action partners that you're talking about. You know, we got to think outside of IRCs that are internal to DOD. We got to start thinking about what does Department of State have? What is assets does a global engagement center have operating in this area? What strategic messaging are they putting out? And how is the embassy, the U.S. embassy and the ambassador viewing this? And what assets do they have that we can integrate with and then attack these problems? If we look at it from that, you can kind of walk it back to, okay, this is an issue. We're talking about China exploiting economic initiatives across. What can a four-person team do with that? Or, you know, a cross-functional team made up of special forces brethren and psychological operations, how do they attack that? And I think there's a numerous ways that we can do that, but it does come back to integrating with unified action partners.
Thank you so much for that, Sean. You know, that brings up another point that I really want to talk about, and I have it right here. You know, this is the vision for 2021 and beyond. First Special Forces Command, first to observe, first to influence, and first to compete. What does that mean to us? What does it mean to our formations as we are aspirational, getting ready to pivot to great power competition? And something that you brought up, I want to really want to focus on is that cross-functional team. You're in a unique position at 7th Group, and you have the ability to have different capabilities around you. And I kind of really wanted to for you to unpack your thoughts on what does that mean to you and the regiment at large as we look specifically at cross-functional teams.
Absolutely, sir. So like you said, I am down at 7th Special Forces Group currently in the Information Dominance Attachment as the NCOIC right now. That's a unique position. I think it's a great time to be here at 7th Group. I think it's a great time to be civil affairs or psychological operations or special forces operating in this environment, right? You know, since I've came into civil affairs about 10 years ago, this term cross-functional teams has been brought up numerous times. And maybe we could get away with it in a coin fight. You know, it's much more kinetically focused. You could get away with not being as integrated, but in great power competition, I don't think it's going to play out in your favor if we don't, right? And I think that Major General Brennan and Colonel Sanis here at 7th Group have done a great job of emphasizing the importance of this. And for me, cross-functional teams, that's where it starts, right? The biggest portion of this is leadership emphasis. If it's not emphasized by the command, and then followed up on by the command, then it's not going to be something that has to happen. Beyond that, I think it's important that each of the tribes understand the capabilities of each other, right? And that's beyond those stereotypes where, you know, talking civil affairs, oh, just soccer balls and wells, which is not the case at all. You're talking PSYOP, you're talking leaflet drops, not the case. You're talking SF, like direct action. No, there's much more to each of those things. You know, you look at civil affairs, we've harped on that. Civil reconnaissance, civil engagement, human network analysis. Those are the things we bring to the fight. And I would venture to say that some of the junior SF guys don't know about human network analysis, or that's a capability that we bring. And I'd say the same thing about our PSYOP brethren as well. When you look at PSYOP, you know, you're looking at target audience analysis. What are the things that will change the behaviors of that population? How do we message that through numerous different platforms and capabilities that they have, right? And then when you're talking about special forces, you're looking at the military partner choice. across all of DOD, in my opinion, right? So these guys are there to train. They're the partner of choice for a lot of our host station partners that we're alongside with. But understanding capabilities, we can sit here and we can have these discussions, but at the end of the day, it may or may not reach the lowest levels. So how do we build that understanding? And that comes through training, right? Training together, pre-mission training prior to coming up. And I'll say this, at Seventh Group, they've done a great job. No longer are the days of, you know, where all of our individual deployment cycles may overlap. So a civil affairs team may see two different ODAs or vice versa, two different, you know, an ODA may work with two different CA teams. So by the time you're figuring out how one works, you know, the next one's rotating in. And the same can be said about our PSYOP teams, right? Seventh Special Forces Group has worked very hard to get, you know, 1st POB, 98th Civil Affairs Battalion, all of the deployment cycles in line. And that's where we are now at this time. So the playbooks are all aligned, right? And so now we're transitioning to a point where we can start to integrate teams from 98th into these training exercises down here. For the same thing with 1st POB. So these ODAs and these teams that are going to deploy together understand uniquely how those individuals on that team operate, the capabilities of each of those teams. They're actually going out performing these tasks together. The exercises are tailored so that these tasks can be trained together. And then these guys and gals are going to deploy forward in the future and do great things in South America, you know, as we start to counter some of our near peer adversaries down there. The vignette, there was nothing in there that involved a kinetic strike, right? So if you look at that, and we're talking about great power competition. So how do these three tribes, this cross-functional team, work together? What would that look like? You know, and theoretically, we can kind of talk about that. And I can just use an example of something that's going on in South America at the moment. So looking at this with a recent example of what's going on, COVID-19, everyone's been affected by it. You look at some of the things that China may be doing in South America, and really they've done it all over, but South America distributing PPE that isn't working. It's not appropriate. The indigenous population is taking it. They're still catching coronavirus, and these things are still spreading. The host nation government's having a hard time dealing with and containing it. Okay, so how does this work? What does it look like for a cross-functional team? So you can understand that through civil reconnaissance, we already talked about it. Civil affairs team identifies this issue. Hey, this PPE is coming in from China. It's not working. This is what is causing the virus to spread. You know, I'm sure working alongside some of those gym partners, CDC would be operating there, host nation government at the local levels, on the Ministry of Health, et cetera, identifying these issues. Okay, so now we bring this back to the team room, looking with our SF brothers and our PSYOP brothers and sisters. What do we do now? Well, PSYOP, hey, you can start a messaging campaign. Here's the populations that we've identified as most vulnerable of using this PPE that is being put out by China that is not working. You can assist the host nation government messaging them, telling them it's not there. Civil affairs team, we can start working to acquire some PPE that is, you know, that will actually do the things that it's supposed to do and prevent coronavirus or help treat it. We can work through the host nation government to do that. And then our SF brothers and sisters that are going to be there working with that partner force to distribute this, perhaps, you know, setting up med caps, whatever it is, working with the partner force to do that portion of it. That's just one example of how a cross-functional team would work just by bringing that in. And now we've done this. We've messaged what our near peer adversaries are doing, how the U.S. and the host nation is working together to assist those indigenous populations through that cross-functional team.
Thanks, Sean. That's an excellent example. You know, Travis, as you're a commander in the 95th, if you had charge to have a cross-functional team, what are some things you would do to set that team up for success? Or what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, so we actually ran into this recently at NTC and really started thinking about, okay, what's the right way to do this? And just like Sean was saying, the key to it is training together and training together early. A cross-functional team, as opposed to, you know, building out a task force where you take one company and attach it to another battalion, you know, or vice versa. In those cases, you still want to train together, but the real friction points usually come to light. Whereas a cross-functional team, if you're putting individuals together immediately prior to conducting your mission or deploying, all that team building steps, like you got to get through while you're on mission, while you're operationally employed, and you don't want to be in that environment. And that's the one thing that we really saw. And that's the thing I always struggle with is a lot of times we build these cross-functional teams, just like a task force, specifically for a mission. And then you break them apart when that mission's no longer, you know, valid or going on, but you lose out on that team building ahead of time. You lose out on that education process on what the capabilities we have and what we bring, what capabilities the other members of that team bring, and working through just the team building and organization of that team. So I can't emphasize enough of, you know, in a lot of cases, you can get the same effects with teams working together. If you're not going to be able to really get them to train together ahead of time, you can have unity of effort still, because you may not be able to get the time to really train them up together. And then you risk that personality conflict that you would work out in training coming to light during operational phase. That's always my caution when we're talking cross-functional teams, is when they work, they work fantastic, but you always got to watch out because they're very, very personality dependent, just because of the close nature of the work they do together, you know, and making sure that the mission for that element is written and designed in the proper way. It's not a CA mission where we just need, you know, more bodies to help us with security. That's just a CA team where you just need an uplift. That's not a cross-functional team. You know, it's not a an SF core mission where you just want some CA folks to do some KLEs, hand out soccer balls, as Sean says, right? So we really got to make sure that as headquarters and as staffs, when we're developing an idea, if we think we want a cross-functional team, not getting ahead of ourselves, understand what it is we're trying to do there. And is a cross-functional team the right capability to apply? And if it is, make sure that the due diligence is done so that that cross-functional team has the mission and intent that supports having the three tribes put together under one organization. Because otherwise, you know, there may be better ways to get after the problem of independent teams working together collaboratively towards a common goal, but their independent missions may not warrant bringing SF guys into a CA team or CA guys into an SF team, because you might want the flexibility to go do different things at the same time. And so it's just that analysis of the mission, that operational analysis, the design to really, really make sure that we're applying this asset against the right problem set and doing it in the right way.
Hey, Roz, as you put your instructor hat on, the director, and you have different countries come through your organization, what are your thoughts about cross-functional teams and what would you share with them?
So cross-functional teams with our partner nations?
Yes.
You know, Our partner nations, I think they're starting to understand our roles, and they're starting to mirror some of the things. And I'm sure Sean can attest to that. You know, like Colombia, they've got their CA and PSYOPs. They work together hand by hand. You know, we bring, you know, their CA guys here, and we train them on CMO activities all the time. We're running courses, you know, right now we're doing them virtually. But talking about cross-functional teams, I want to go back to what Travis was talking about. You know, making sure that, you know, at what level do you need them, right? So, you know, maybe at the tactical level, teams are running independently, but maybe you need a cross-functional team at the company or battalion level, at that echelon, depending on what it is, and making sure that everybody knows what their roles are. I think that's one of the gaps when I was the 5th Group 9 was, you know, everybody was off cycle, 9th PSYOP battalion, you know, they were off cycle compared to Siege of Sort of Syria, compared to the 95th guys that were coming to support us. And then the other piece was usually we'd get teams to come do PMT with us, but we never get the, you know, company level headquarters or anybody else because they're busy. They've got competing requirements. So then they show up when they're deployed. So I think doing that early on, if we're going to start developing cross-functional teams from echelons, you know, company and above, is making sure that they're there early enough to be able to develop those relationships with the people they're working with and identifying their roles.
Well, gents, I mean, this has been a fantastic conversation. You know, I want to give a special thanks to all of you for joining me on today. Definitely want to thank your commanders and Travis, you know, our commander, Colonel Nutt, for giving us this space to highlight what's going on in the brigade. And then Major General Brennan for allowing us the opportunity to talk about this indigenous approach. It's really important to educate all our brethren, our soft brethren, about what we bring to the fight and what we can accomplish together. So with that said, hey, thanks. I'll see you on the high side. Order from chaos.
This has been the Indigenous Approach. We hope you have enjoyed this episode. Follow us on social media. And if you have suggestions for topics or guests, send us a message. Thank you for listening.